You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Hello, welcome please to Telstra Customer Service. How may I be helping you?
Conform or be consumed.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history.
I heard a rumour today.
I like your rumours.
I know, as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school, how can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
What is your environmental policy?
To sell Telstra.
You heard of road rage?
Yes.
What about web rage?
And within a few minutes.
Minutes?
Yeah, minutes. It's not minutes. XG, mate.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome to the next Tech Talk Radio Summer Series installment. It's Dr. Ron here, and it's great having you on board as always. First of all, Happy New Year to everyone listening. I hope it's a great one for you and your families, and I hope you enjoyed your time off over the Christmas break. You'll be pleased to know that Melbourne experienced its hottest New Year's Eve in its hottest year on record. The mercury hits 41 here on the 31st of December. That's about 106 for our US brethren. So no one here really gives two hoots at the moment about technology. We're all too busy trying to keep cool and to stay hydrated. This is why it's called the Summer Series. Apologies to Mark, of course, who's now in Boston and he's battling snowdrifts and icicles and such things. As you know, the Tech Talk Radio crew is currently on holidays, so in the meantime, we're showcasing some of our program highlights in this entertaining Summer Series that you'll see right through to February. Now, in this instalment, we'll be hearing from Justin Dunlop, self-confessed Mac guru, and he'll be talking all about the latest Australian news on the Apple's iPhone, the popular iPod music players, iTunes, iMovie, iDVD, iLife 08, and pretty much everything, I think, starting with the letter I. And we're also revisiting the guys from Net Registry, a popular Australian internet registrar. Sam Shetty and Justin Freeman will be talking all about search engine optimization. I'm Dr. Ron, you'll be hearing again from me a little bit later, but for now, it's on with the show.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Anyway, welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Dr. Ron is on the panel this evening. Mark Diggins is here. And our guest this evening is Justin Dunlop. We're going to talk about Macintosh and all things along those lines. Now, a bit of a tease there before we went to the break. One thing I want to ask about, let's start the ball off rolling because with the one from left hand, iTouch, which is the new device. It's the iPhone without the phone. It's the Maxwell Smart equivalent of, you know, something you want to have that you can't use in this country.
This is the iPod, which looks like an iPhone.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are they any good? Are they available here yet, Justin?
They are available here. There's a few people, I think, that have started playing with them already. A few complaints about the screen quality, apparently. Come in two models, an 8GB and a 16GB. And I guess that sort of goes to some of the rumours about the next of the iPhones, because at the moment the iPhones are an 8GB device.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some leaked information from T-Mobile in Germany about a 16GB iPhone. And the fact that the iTouch is already out with 16 gigs, it sort of confirms the rumour that that's what they're moving towards.
It's the same container, really, isn't it? Why wouldn't it fit?
That's exactly right. So it's a 3.5-inch touch screen, and I guess the breakthrough here, which you've probably covered already, is it's multi-touch, so you can use more than one finger, so you can stretch images on it and you can reduce images on it, and I'm pretending with my fingers in front of
the microphone. It's good for radio.
It's excellent, isn't it? So instead of just putting one finger and moving around like a mouse, you can actually use two fingers and spread them apart, and that'll make an image wider. Or move your two fingers together and it'll make an image smaller.
It's worth going to have a look at the Apple keynotes by Mr. Jobs. Yes. On the Apple.com site. He does demonstrate them quite well. He's got that down to a fine art. If you want to see a man in blue jeans, white runners and a black T-shirt demonstrate things, good spot.
Where can you buy them over here, Justin?
The touches are available off the Apple website or any of the Apple stores, I believe. Certainly on the website, because I checked it out the other day.
And they're selling them into Australia, are they?
Oh, absolutely. Yep. It's just the phones that they're not at the moment. From Apple, you can certainly import them through eBay and other sources, and I guess that's where I'm going to be going shortly.
Well, even tonight, Adam Turner was reporting that someone has got one working on Optus here in this country, according to one of the new blogs from the Sydney Morning Herald, so watch this space. But you were saying something off-air just before about the fact that we might be getting a 2.5G version. Well, that's what's happening in Europe at the moment anyway.
Well, certainly the iPhone at the moment is a GSM phone in the US, and the recent press releases about O2, T-Mobile and the various other European carriers have indicated that it'll be GSM over there as well. Some of the rumour sites that have disassembled their iPhone suggest that there's a 3G chip in there. However, there's no indication in any of the press releases that they'd use that technology at this stage.
Now, I bagged it big time when I found out it was 2.5G and GPRS and slow and what was saying, why would you release a device that only does 2.5G? And one of our listeners came back and said, you know, you watch it take off, it'll be great and all that sort of thing. And we were talking from a technology point of view, and I'm sure it will take off, and it's got, you know, the multi-touch screen, and it's got all the nice things that Apple do and do it well. But from a technology point of view, I don't think any of us would buy it being only 2.5G. So
when you think about a broadband experience, which is what a lot of these new devices are promising,
it'd be a big step backwards.
It'd be disappointing.
It's got the great new screen. It's got the multi-touch and that sort of thing. It's all the good things you want. And then all the content that's going to come into it, it's all very slow. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, well, in Steve's release, press release in the UK, he was saying he's got something else in mind, better than 3G, so we'll have to wait and see.
What's better than 3G?
Apart from 4G?
That's kind of interesting. In the press release, he's talking about the fact that it's got a wireless Ethernet built in, which is, yeah, that's fine. Lots of things do.
The women call of a telco to a lot of extent about what this device can actually do when you plug it in. You know, if the network doesn't support the speeds, well, what are you going to do?
You're pretty limited.
Yeah. Anyway.
So anyway, that's the news with the touch. They've updated the other iPods. There's new colours for the Shuffle.
Yeah, they've gone pastel.
Pastel colours, pastel blue, pastel green, purple.
iPastel.
Yes,
quite. It is. It's very subtle, but it's very pastely. And you buy the red one and you still chip in towards
Seems to be the go. I think the Nintendo DSs are pastel colours now too.
Well, that's nice.
Must be the latest. You know?
I guess the big news is the Nano's now got wider and does video. And the what we would have called the iPod Video or the iPod Photo is now the iPod Classic.
Yeah, that's the old traditional UBIT because it never had a name.
so we call it a Classic.
Yeah, exactly. The generic one.
So for those of us, Justin, that are iPod ignorants like myself, we've got the very smallest one that's the size of a postage stamp.
The Nano.
That's the Shuffle. That's the Shuffle.
Oh, the Shuffle.
No screen on it.
Now, they're about $100, aren't they?
They're just on $99.
And it's got
apparently.
A little dial on them so you can track forward and back and volume up and down.
I use the first generation Shuffle, which is the sort of the chewing packet size.
Yeah, yep.
And I really quite like it because it's nice and small and I can use it as a memory stick. In fact, I use it more as a memory stick than
I do as a Shuffle.
The ones
I've seen are about the size of a 20-cent piece, except they're square, but that's about the size.
They're the brand new ones?
Yeah. Yep.
And I guess the only downside of those is you don't have a playlist, so it's just either consecutive or it's random. You don't get to choose that I want these 10 songs now or those 10 songs later.
Okay.
So it's a downfall, but it's quite cheap.
Listening to albums the way they were supposed to be listened to, sequentially.
Yeah.
Not so fantastic when you accidentally hit the shuffle button, as I have when you've had a whole lot of podcasts to try to listen to and you're jumping through dates. It's been interesting.
So that'd be a problem. The next size up is the...
Is the Nano.
The Nano, okay. And that's the one that's about the size of a... I don't know, how would you describe it? It's probably fits in the palm of your hand, thin, skinny.
Two and a half inches, roughly, square.
Yeah.
Now, the Nano's got the new one, isn't it? The new Nano's the one with the bigger screen, the bigger colour screen.
It hasn't got a bigger screen. It's got a bigger resolution than the screen, if I recall.
No, it's a bigger screen
as well. It's a two-inch screen now.
Is it? Yeah. Is it the one that's got up to 204 pixels per inch? Is that the one?
The one we use at work, yeah. We've got an old Nano at work, and it's the screen size is about the size of a postage stamp, maybe a little bit bigger, whereas the new one's got a screen you can actually see your video on rather than just looking at...
I still don't think watching a movie or something like that cuts it at that sort of size. You'd have to spend a long time on the train, I reckon.
Now, has that got a hard disk in it, Justin, or is that...
No, that's a flash drive.
Memory, flash drive?
That's flash. Oh, correction. No, the Nano is a flash drive.
Yeah,
you're
it's
right.
Flash, yeah.
And you can do a 4 gig or an 8 gig model. The Classic is the one with the hard drive, and there's two options now, 80 gigs and 160 gigabytes.
Oh, caramba, wow. 160 gigs.
How many MP3s can you get on that?
All of them.
Now, one thing...
Crikey.
How many MP4s?
No, that's right. No, you can't because you've got all your stock music exactly. And stuff. You've got bajillions of tracks.
Now, these things too have gone to an alloy case, haven't they, Justin? This is to hopefully stop them cracking.
Everything's gone thin and metal, yes.
That's good so that it doesn't, when you accidentally sit on it in your back pocket, you don't go, oh dear, there was the iPod.
So it's 160 now rather than cracks.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, they need to have that flexible PCB inside of it too. That'd be good, wouldn't it?
So that's the iPod's pretty much covered. There was a new release of iMac at the Macworld Festival recently, and basically they've gone aluminium now. So they look more metal than they do white plastic.
Aluminum, our
aluminum,
United
right.
States listeners would say.
We just need the transparent aluminum from Star Trek.
Yes.
And we'll be fine. the illusion
Boy,
of
that
them,
was good.
The illusion of them being thin, though, apparently is just an illusion. They're actually just as thick in the centre, but they've angled the case. So from certain angles, it looks a lot thinner. But
it's
in reality,
Star Trek aluminium.
It's just, exactly right.
Aluminum.
Or maybe it's the TARDIS and it's changing size. But so there's new IMAX out. They've dropped the 17-inch model. So you start at 20 inches and go up to a 24-inch screen with a 2.8 gigahertz processor. So there's quite a bit of bang in for your buck there.
Did
the
it
prices,
hurt?
Yeah, absolutely. The prices have dropped a little, but apparently so is the quality of the 20-inch screen. So for those of you going out to buy one, go for the 24-inch screen. It's better. And at the same time, they updated the Mac Mini, which is a little sort of media centre.
I thought they were going to decommission that and put it out to pasture, but they've brought it back, haven't
well,
they?
Well, they've done so little with it for so long that people thought it was its days were numbered, but they've updated it to the new Core 2 Duos. It wasn't previously, so they're available again and at reasonable prices, I guess, depending what you want to spend. So there's a couple of new products around, and obviously the other products are still chugging along, the MacBooks and so forth. There's lots of rumours about a sub-notebook coming out very soon with retractable ports and no optical drives and no floppy drives or CD drives or anything else. So it'll be interesting to see what that looks like when it's
so
when
it comes. One of those ones great for the plane, you've got no leg room and arm room and all that sort of thing?
That sort of thing, and no keyboard either. It'd be so small. But, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they do. Maybe it'll be a touchscreen machine. We don't know.
Okay.
So that's the news with the hardware. Now, I believe your listeners had some questions about software.
I had some contentious issues with... We created a software suite, apparently.
Did
just,
you?
Yeah, just because we could. We called it iStudio or something.
No, something like that.
Something, yeah, slip of the tongue, and everyone's saying, where do we get the iStudio? And we went, oh, actually, doesn't exist. Just disregard.
I think that's a great product. You should suggest it or write it. I'm sure you'll make lots of money.
Who's got their phone on?
So just to clarify, there is no such thing as an iStudio.
Well, there's lots of studio products. They've got Logic Studio and they've got Final Cut Studio. So they've got a suite of projects in the studio range.
That's what we were thinking of.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. So maybe we should have a bit of a chat about iLife 08, which is...
Well, this is all the new. This has just come out, hasn't it?
It has, even though it's only 07. So
I like one of the new features I like in it is being able to organise your photos better into events, I think he calls it,
yes.
Doesn't it?
Yep, that's right. It will automatically order your photos in events based on date and sort of similarity.
Can I do a quick straw poll? How many photos have you got on your machine, Dr. Ron? Are we talking hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands?
Thousands.
Yeah. Mark?
About 1,000.
Okay. Graham, who's over there? Just gesture Bromley.
100 or so.
Okay, now I must admit, I would be the odd one out here. I would have probably over 1,000 because I've got young kids, you see.
Oh, I've got about 5,000 in mind.
Okay,
so
yeah. Now this is where this new event managing thing sounded really, really good. Can you tell me how it works?
Sure. Well, let's just go through iLife, all right? So there's a couple of products in this bundle, and it's really the entry bundle for the home user. So there's iPhoto, which is what you're talking about, manages your photos. GarageBand, if you're a sort of backyard muso, want to break into that sort of area and use your computer to generate music.
Yeah, create podcasts and stuff. People use
you
GarageBand.
You can do that too.
Yep.
Absolutely, although the audio quality on GarageBand for podcasts is pretty poor.
Oh, okay.
From some of the other programs that I've been involved with. iMovie got updated. They've redesigned the interface and so forth, and that's pretty contentious. Two things about it. Firstly, it doesn't work if you haven't got a brand new computer. So if you've got a G4 like me, then you're left out in the cold. You have to use iMovie 06. But because of the changed interface, people are saying, oh, it's a lot harder to use. And the reverse camp that think it's really good say, well, that's just because you're so used to the old product. So the jury's out a little bit about the movie bit. iDVD, which allows you to generate a DVD from the iMovies that you've made. And then iWeb, which allows you to publish all of this stuff online. And of course, you can publish it where you like, but Apple would prefer you to buy a .Mac account for $139 a year and upload it all to their system. And of course,
sure
it made it easy
would.
To do that, but you know, it's money in the pocket, isn't it? Mm. So getting back to iPhoto, I use iPhoto a lot. I maintain an online gallery for my children's photos so that rallies overseas and interstate can see them.
Do you publish online?
I do. But it's not publicly available. You need a password and so forth to get into it. But yes, I publish all our family photos online. And I use iPhoto to manage all of that. I export to it's an open source program called Gallery, which some of you may know, but uses the PHP type language. And it requires a SQL database. We can talk about those things perhaps later. But I've got a plugin for iPhoto that allows me to select photos and export it directly to my online package. Works quite well. Now, you're asking about the automatic organisation in iPhoto now. With these events, as you load photos in, iPhoto tries to work out things that happened on the same day, and if there's any indication in the file name about the commonality, it'll lump them together and say, this is all about a birthday, or this is all about going to work, or this is all about some other function.
Yep.
So when you go into the event manager, it actually orders all of your photos and groups them into events without you having to do anything to it, which I found kind of useful, although at the end of the day, I like to pick and choose, so I use a general library for that sort of thing. iPhoto, though, I really quite like it. I don't use it to nearly the fullest extent, but I still think it's a great product. Working up from that, so that's iLife 08, and it manages your media from a home user's point of view. There's iWork, which perhaps you were talking about as well, which is to provide an entry-level sort of Microsoft Office-type product.
Yeah. So we're comparing the Apple offering with what Microsoft...
Is there an Outlook equivalent now, is there?
Well, Apple have always had Mail built into their operating system. So in terms of Outlook, there's always been Mail and there's always been Calendar.
Yeah, I mean more for a calendar-ish sort of interactive thing where people send you meeting notifications and you click accept or go away or suggest
well,
a new one.
That's already built into OS X, not all that compatible with Outlook. But that's part of the operating system. In iWork, which is like the productive package, they've got Pages, which is a word processor. They've got Numbers, which is a spreadsheet, which is pretty new, and Keynote, which is a presentation program.
I love Keynote. Keynote is the equivalent of PowerPoint, and it absolutely does nasty things to PowerPoint. If you actually sit down and had a look at Keynote, it's sensational.
Yeah, I haven't used any of these in any great way other than to open them, have a bit of a play and see what they do. But most of them, I'll take your comments about Keynote. I haven't used it as much as you have. But certainly with Pages and Numbers, if you want an entry-level product and you're getting used to word processing, you want something to do it at home, then it's a good product. I'm not sure that I'd use Numbers over Excel just yet, though.
Okay. A lot of these programs are going into XML formats. Open Office XMLs, Microsoft's go at it. Are any of these programs starting to use the XML file format so they're compatible with other
applications? They'll certainly export to a range of file types, but I haven't explored XML, no. So iWork's there as the entry-level sort of Office product. And then in terms of multimedia, because the Apple's always been associated with multimedia more than mainstream commerce, there's some professional suites for the photographer. There's Aperture, which is a professional photo editing suite. There's Logic Studio for the musos that allow you to either pre-record your music or generate your music on your computer. Mainstage, which allows you to use your computer to do live performances. And then there's a range of other things for publishing and sampling and so forth. Then there's Final Cut Studio, which is the video editing suite. Comes with a range of processors, and you can get a cut-down version, an Xfresh version of that. And then there's a few bolt-ons. So there's things like Shake 4.1, which I've only just learnt about, which allows you to do some post video processing and putting in special effects and so forth. So they've got a range of products particularly aimed at the multimedia market, which I guess is where Apple's always excelled. And they're starting to get into the more mainstream word processing spreadsheet area with iWork 08. So there's a lot of products around for the diehard Macs. And obviously now with the new Intel version of the iMac and Mac Pro, if you want to use a Microsoft product, well, you can boot up Windows if you like and use the Windows suite as well.
Providing you've got Bootcamp loaded up or something like that, I guess.
Bootcamp or Parallels or one of the other emulator products, yes. Yeah.
Look, I think there's a lot of interesting new products that have come out there. I think Apple is certainly taking heed of what their market is saying. How do they go with interactivity at the moment between applications? Like if you make something in Final Cut, can you export that into, say, iMovie to take your movie file and put onto DVD? Or is it all just... Do you find that they all talk with each other?
They certainly do. They probably don't go in that direction because you've gone from the professional suite backwards, and I don't know many people who go in that direction. But certainly if you use iPhoto to generate your photos, which we do, and you use iMovie to capture your video off your video camera, you can bring and use GarageBand, for example, to make your own soundtrack. You can bring them all together to publish into iDVD. So, yes, they certainly integrate very well. I guess that's really where Apple have excelled with this
Exactly
product.
Right. And from a domestic and a home user point of view, you've got the competition, which is really Microsoft and those sort of suites. But even still, they don't talk seamlessly like what the Mac products seem to do, especially with their drag and drop and bring from one application to another. They do it very well.
That's right. And I guess one of the criticisms of the new iMovie 08 is that there's no timeline involved. It's more about dropping scenes and dropping photos and dropping sound files.
Well, it's what you're used to, though, isn't it?
Which I think for the basic user is what they need.
But as you were saying before, you know, because people aren't used to this form of timeline, or you know, I come from a video editing background, I thrive on a timeline, but if I didn't have a timeline, there you go, well, how do you trim, how do you do this? But if you're not used to that, if they're trying to bring you into, and this might be the case for this level of video editing, you just want to drag your image you've brought in off your DV camera and drop it in here, and you want to drag a couple of stills from over there and put them up as, you know, title slides. How easy is that? That was one of the good things about their DVD authoring platform. It was very, very easy. And I guess we all hate instruction manuals, don't we? So intuitiveness in software is really important, especially for a lot of users who just don't have that, you know, techie gene in their body.
That's
right. I'm sure you know what I mean.
So in iMovie, it actually presents you with a list of everything in your library. So all of the photos, all the events, as we were talking about a moment ago, all of the video clips that you have available and some of the sound files you've got available in iTunes, for example, and you can just drag them from your iTunes area across into the movie. You can move them around to be at the beginning or the end. The new version of iMovie, I don't think, is so sophisticated about being able to segment parts of the audio to match the video. But again, for an entry-level user, that's probably a much better project to have than something with more sophisticated editing processes.
Mm. No, it's very good, Justin. If we look at the options that like Microsoft Windows has, there's nothing, I guess, that is integrated that tightly. Like we've got the Office productivity suite, and sure, we can open a Word document and we can paste an Excel spreadsheet segment into it, or we can, you know, do something like that. We can move around between applications. But if we want to do something like serious graphics editing, we're not going to use Paint. You know, we're going to be loading up a software application that's written by a third party, nothing
so
to do with Microsoft.
Photoshop, Illustrator.
That's right. Or if we're going to be doing some video editing, we're going to be using something completely different. We're not going to be running up, you know, Windows Media Player to do stuff. So it's good. It's something that Apple's got in their favour, certainly.
You know, one of the good things?
Tight integration with these packages.
They're integrating games into these new iPod devices too at the moment. I think there's one of them comes out with three video games built in as standard. So when you get bored on the tram, bus, wherever, plane, wherever you might
have
the
beat, playing games
you can,
as well.
You can get into the games. I think that's good. That's listening to their users, isn't it? You're like, drive yourself absolutely batty after a while playing games on your little iPod. That would be a very small device, but that's where it's all going.
Which is fantastic. The interesting thing is that if you bought the games for your last generation iPod, you have to buy them again for your new generation iPod.
Oh, now that's going to be ruffle feathers, I would have thought.
Is it a new version? Like, is it not compatible and that's why you have to do it, or is it just a money-making exercise?
I don't know the difference, to be honest. It's a bit like iMovie 08 supposedly doesn't work on my G4 Cube that I use at home, which is an older Macintosh. But in fact, if you know what you're doing, you can hack it so that it will load, and I've done that. It runs very, very slowly, but it does run.
Okay.
So I don't know whether it's fact or fiction, whether it's just an enforced you must pay now because it's a different model, or whether there's a technology reason behind it. I'm not sure.
There's a level of ignorance out there which isn't acceptable.
Didn't John Howard drop past to get permission to call an election?
What did you use before Next-G for data?
iBurst. The screen is actually a lot larger than any of the previous iPod models.
We've spoken before about the trade-off between usability and security.
Apple have been accused of an unlawful monopoly.
No, it's not true.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show.
You know, here we go again.
Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Well, let's get the crystal ball out. What's happening? What have we got to look forward to from the Macintosh point of view? We've touched briefly on the new OS for Christmas in the stocking, potentially, maybe.
Yeah, the new OS maybe for Christmas. Well, it's meant to be this year. It's certainly meant to be this year. And it's been seeded again just at the moment to developers, so no doubt that'll happen. As I mentioned earlier, there's some rumours about a sub-notebook coming out. So. To be smaller than the notebook and with a touch-sensitive overlay, that'd be fantastic, wouldn't it? I think so. So the iMacs have just been updated, so I guess the next thing is to look for the new laptops. And there are some rumours about an ultra-thin PowerBook MacBook and MacBook Pro, probably matching the aluminium case of the iMac. So they're the things on the horizon. And there may well be some other technologies. There's some rumours about the Apple TV getting an update.
That would be good, wouldn't it? Because Apple TV has a lot of potential, but I just don't think It's quite there yet.
Have you got one?
No, I haven't. No. Actually, might remember the last time I said I wouldn't bother because I couldn't see it being any better than what I've got. I use an iHome, which is a very early product made by Elgato. What I have found, though, is that it's starting to age a bit, the product that I've got. So, you know, I bought it for $50 online.
Got your money's worth?
I did, absolutely. Yeah. It's worth $50.
That's the key to it, isn't it? As long as you've got your money's worth, it doesn't matter. It can be superseded.
So the Apple TV got updated since we spoke last. So its hard drive now can go up to 160 gigabytes. And if you hack it, you can make an even bigger one if you want. But that's for synchronization. It's not for storage of particular media. They've found backdoors into the machine so you can load extra codecs, which is really what I was missing out on. I wanted to use the codecs that I'm currently using, DivX and so forth.
Well, that's good because that was always its downfall, really, wasn't it? Because you couldn't... And even connectivity between a Mac or to non-Mac devices was also a bit of an issue there for a time.
That's right. You needed a Mac basically at the other end to be providing the content off iTunes.
Yeah, I was about to say you needed the content indexed in an iTunes library on the remote machine, didn't you?
And of course on an Apple would make it a lot easier. I presume it works with PCs. I've not actually read about that, but I assume it works with PCs as well. So there's some rumours about an updated Apple TV, so I'll be watching those.
And it'll be interesting to see what happens because there's a lot of other good sort of like other manufacturers are bringing out all sorts of whiz-bang things these days to compete with the same. So they're like Beyond Wiz and all those guys have got their own gadgets and things out there as now as well. So it's going to become a fairly competitive market. And if you're a Mac guru, well then, yeah, you've got lots to choose from.
Lots to play with. And one of the things that that it's actually missing is a web browser. Given it's got internet connectivity and the whole idea is you download movies off iTunes to watch on your Apple TV, it didn't actually have a web browser in it. So you couldn't actually go and surf the net on your TV, which in fact my old device, my $50 one does. So
which you think would make a lot of sense because you've got network connectivity there. Why not?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it was to keep the system closed. And it's a bit like the iPhone. Really, the iPhone and the Apple TV are paralleling themselves a little bit. The business market is all around who's going to sell you the network service or the download service.
The next thing is going to be electronic program guides, which we've touched on here on this show from time to time. The ability to actually say, I want to record Doctor Who or Star Trek or whatever, and not have to worry about the time when the networks move them all around the place.
So. And you probably won't get that on the Apple TV because the Apple product range is based around buying everything off iTunes. So you buy the product for, you know, $500, but then you buy for the continual download. So it's unlikely you'll see from Apple a solution for free-to-air TV or
even supports cable TV. a third-party episode guide.
So it sounds like the AV department in your shelf in the home entertainment system is just going to grow a little bit more. You'll have all sorts of gadgets sitting there fairly shortly, hopefully connected wirelessly, which would be just terrific. We'll have to wait and see. Justin, it's been absolutely fantastic catching up with all the Mac stuff that's out there. Hopefully we've put the right answers into a lot of people's minds this time around, and the forum will settle down a bit, Dr. Ron.
Oh, that's good.
My work here is done. Thank you very much.
Your work is, we will have you back.
Your work is never done. We'll have you back very soon,
We'll
Justin.
Have to have you back for the Christmas special so everyone knows what to buy.
Definitely. Okay.
Plasma TVs may be banned. Oh, my goodness.
I don't care. They will pry my plasma out of my cold, dead hand.
Microsoft issued 7 security patches in a regular update.
Yep, there's a debate as to whether by turning off the ads, you're effectively stealing the content.
What about the three of us? We could give up our day jobs.
Yes, absolutely.
We could be the three amigos.
We could.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Dr. Ron, Graham Callaghan and myself, Andrew McComb here on the panel this evening. We've entered. Our server's gone into overload if you're trying to connect to the Tech Talk Radio facilities at this point in time.
We're in the Tech Talk Radio twilight zone.
Please try again later. Oh, dear.
Did we upset the wrong people?
I don't know.
Did we say something wrong?
I don't know. Let's change the subject. Search engine optimization.
Oh, yes.
This is... From connecting to the internet to using it now, people put websites up and blogs, all sorts of things, and they want it to be found in Google. Or do they? What we're going to talk about now is optimizing your website for actually being found for what you want to be found for on Google. Now, Dr. Ron, you and I, we went into the city. We were we should probably at this point in time say we were invited by Net Registry to go along.
We were. I'm a Net Registry reseller.
Yeah,
the business that I have, and I think you are.
Yes,
as well,
I have
Andrew.
Dealings with Net Registry, so we thought should put that on the table. You don't?
No,
that's good. All right,
Graham's nice and objective.
Now, the reason for sort of search engine optimization these days is because of organisations such as Google, 9MSN and all those sort of people indexing your site and coming back and continuing to re-index your site. So what we thought we would do is actually shed a bit of light onto how to do that.
We're going to be talking about Google, but this applies to all search engines. I put my thinking cap on at the start of tonight's show when I was getting ready, and I was trying to come up with 10 search engines.
Wonder what that noise was.
Yeah, that was my thinking cap. I could get to about 4 or 5
what did
at
you,
an absolute stretch.
Really? How'd you go?
Yeah. Google, it's just all pervasive and used 80, by everyone.
85%, 86%.
Of all searches done on the internet today are done
according
by Google.
To Hitwise?
I could think of Yahoo.
Yeah.
The 9MSN, MSN Search, yep. That sort of search engine. Alta Vista I used to use before Google was big, and Lycos.
What about Telstra? Is that half-hearted effort called Census? I mean, what do they call it?
Is Census...
Answers. Answers was one.
Yeah, that's
one. Never used
What was the Census one called? I can't even remember. That was their fledgling. Why would you even try and compete with Google on that? And we got Wiki about to start one too.
Well, that's right. Wiki's going to start their own search
Wiki
engine.
Wiki search. Okay.
Correct.
Well, see, Wiki don't make money on anything, and they need to turn... they're all volunteers over there, but they want to turn it into a business thing. So how do you do that? You start a search engine.
Mm. Of course you do.
Anyway, search engine optimization is an established process of improving how your website interacts with search engines, thereby boosting your overall search engine ranking and website traffic. One of the things which we all probably do is we write words for people to read. Now, one of the things which came across, I think, during the course of the week is when you're writing copy, that is the words that go on the page, you want to tell Google, or the search engine for that matter, that this is a page about blue widgets, if you're selling blue widgets. You don't want to confuse the blue widgets with red widgets, with grey Who's a Majigger Watchers or anything like that. It's a page about blue widgets. So when people come to your site, or when people link to your site, the page is about what it says it is. Now, on a web page, there's a number of things apart from the text that you put on, the copy, which we've just mentioned. One very important thing, which a lot of people overlook, is the title of the page. How many times have you guys been to a web page and it says...
New page one.
Untitled page.
Untitled.
If you do a search on Google for untitled page, I should actually do this while we are connected to some form of technology. I can't reach the keypad from here, and I need both hands. But if you do a search for untitled web page, chances are there'll be tens of millions of the damn things because people don't go and label their page.
Hmm.
According to Google, that's one of the most important things you can do is to put the title of the page.
Yep. It sounds like such an obvious thing, but something which people often forget.
Exactly. Now, the other thing which you can do, there's these things called meta tags. Meta tags, it's, you know, lingo, jingo, whatever you want to call it, behind the wonderful World Wide Web page front. Meta tags are just simply lines of text which are not visible to your search engine. Not visible to your readers, but are visible to your search engine. And normally there's just two ones. One's a description, which is it was supposed to be just a single line there telling you about the page that you were on. So the meta tag is, welcome to...
TikTok Radio.
Yep, and we are this. And then underneath that you have your meta, so like search tags, where you put in all your search phrases
keywords.
And things like that. Yeah,
radio,
keywords.
Technology, technical, yep. Podcast.
Now, how many of you think a keyword is a word? It's a Freudian answer to this. Oh, sorry. Yes, one of those really dumb things. Well, a keyword is not a word. It's a group of words. A keyword is what you type into that little bar that lives under the words Google. How many of you type in one word?
No, I type in as many as I can, as many as I think are relevant, because I want to narrow the search and I want to get precise search results.
That's a very valid point.
Am I alone or am I...
No, that's good. So,
I hope you're not alone.
But when you think of a keyword, people think, oh, I'm going to sell cars. So a keyword is Ford. Well, yes. What about Ford Festiva? What about the brand? What about Subaru Liberty?
I would type in a suburb as well.
Yeah, yeah. Now you're thinking how people use search engines. Now, this is where search engine optimization comes into its forefront. Because... it's not just Google that changes its acronyms. It's the way we use things like Google and 9MSN and how they index us. Because after all, the search engines are there as a service to us, the users, and to present you information which is relevant to what you're looking. So as you said, Dr. Ron, rightly so, choose lots of words to put into your keyword search.
Ford Festiva, car sales.
Suburb maybe.
Suburb maybe and...
Yeah.
Yeah. But, and new or used? Yeah. Yeah.
And let's think you were thinking for service, Toyota service Melbourne, Toyota service Cairns. You would put in those words. So when you're thinking about putting keywords on your site, use that group of three words or four words, whatever, as a keyword so that you've got more chance of being found for that. And it means that people are being more specific in their searches, and as a result, the search engines can return a more specific set of results. Very important in today's search engine optimization. Another interesting thing too that Google likes is named anchors. Now, do you know what a named anchor is?
Yes.
Good. You want to tell everyone?
It's a way of giving a block of text on your site a name that you can refer to so that you can link to a particular place on the page.
Spot on. How many click here places do you think you'll find on someone's website? That's a very...
Click here is a dreadful thing to do.
I exactly. overuse that, and it's completely meaningless when it comes to search engines. Like, if we say... to have a look at this week's gadget of the week on the Tech Talk Radio website, click here.
Instead of saying click here, you say look at Tech Talk's gadget of the week and make gadget of the week the link.
That's right. But a lot of people put the words click here as the link, and it's completely meaningless when it's indexed.
Now, most search engines love named anchors because it's got the poor little robot. It's not human like us. It's a mechanical beast. It's dumb. But at least it knows where it's going when you say click here to go to the or gadget of the week or visit our gadget of the week. It'll take you through to that. So that's what they call a named anchor. And it's very important for using those to navigate through your site and to other people's sites, which is something that you need to be very aware of. Another interesting thing that came to the forefront is that Google at the moment likes putting or it likes you if you put services or something that would draw your... web readers to your site, a free thing, such as a calculator. You want to calculate how to convert A to B. And if you put a little calculator on your website, Google goes, oh, this is helpful. This is pretty good. It also means that other people that are in the same industry say, oh, there might be a, if you want to check out how to do this, click and visit this website. And it'll take you across there. And that in itself is a benefit to your website.
So if you've got a calculator on your page to work out how many blue widgets you need to do a particular job, then they're more likely to come to your site to calculate that and then buy their blue widgets from you.
Exactly. So as a result, the search engines are seeing you as an authoritative type of web page.
And also as providing a free service to people who are using the web as well. Not just you're not just promoting a product or a service of yours. You're actually providing a free service online. Mm. And Google like that a lot in terms of ranking your web page.
Now, Dr. Ron, we went to the SEO conference. We're going to play a little bit about that in a minute. But one thing I'd like to touch on is what you shouldn't do on a web page. Now, how many of you do the following here? And you're probably going to cringe and go, oh, no. Okay, here's
can I have a guess?
Okay.
A website designed completely in Flash.
That's the top of the list. Yes.
Oh, there you go.
Avoid using entirely Flash designs, as a majority of search engines cannot index Flash-only sites. Now, I can name half a dozen sites that are Flash-only sites. You web designers that are too clever by half, they look fantastic.
Listen up.
But functionality-wise, let me tell you, you will not be found in Google, apart from the front page or the domain name that you have on your page.
There is a way that you can actually see what the Googlebot sees.
There is.
Now, the Googlebot is the machine that Google uses to trawl through the web and look at your site and pretend that it's a user and it's visiting your site and indexing everything. And you can actually, when you type in a search on Google, you can actually click on, off the top of my head, I can't think of what it is the cache link?
You can.
To the results.
Yes.
And you can see what it is that the Googlebot is actually seeing. And on a Flash site, there's nothing there. There's no text at all. And it doesn't know how to index anything. So what Andrew's saying is very important.
On the positive side of Flash, you can use Flash. Flash looks nice. Don't use it in a navigation because Google can't see into the navigation to find the other pages that you're pointing to.
Or if you do, provide an alternative navigation tool on the same page.
Yes, exactly. What you should do is use Flash for things like banners. And don't call them banners. Call them headlines. Call them anything but banners. Because there are, let's take a look at Kaspersky antivirus. That'll block out of the box. It'll block a file name called banner. So
that's a good tip.
Anyone using Kaspersky antivirus and you've called banner 1, banner 2, banner 3 on different pages of your website, Kaspersky will say, nah, that's advertising. I'm not going to let it through. So you've got to bear that in mind as well. Let's get back onto the list. Don't use the same color text as your background, even if it's in an image. That's a bit of a no-no.
Yes, quite often you see that. They've got a white text and a white background, but the white text is on top of a dark image. But if so, if the image displays, it's fine. But if you're not displaying the image for some reason, you can't read the text.
That's right. BMW in Europe was found guilty by the Google Meister about doing things like this and deceiving people. Because Google looks for deception. If you are deceiving people, it will not index you.
Yeah, what they did was they had lots of extra keywords at the bottom of the page in the same colour text as background.
That's
so that you couldn't see it. So it was there on the page, but you couldn't read it.
So yes. They have the word BMW.
As Maxwell Smart says, the old black text on the black background trick.
Yeah.
So they were trying to do that to leverage the ranking of their page.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. Avoid hiding search engine rich content behind a layer. Search engines tend to favor simplistic code. Oh, how true that is.
Yep.
HTML is a wonderful thing, base standard ASP or any of the languages are good, but don't get too tricky, because as soon as you start doing Java pop-ups and stuff like that, you're going to ask for all sorts of problems. Yep. When it comes to a search engine optional, sort of, you know, making it friendly for everybody. Try to avoid using frames. That went out the door years ago, but I haven't seen a site with frames in it for years. That was hideous. Remember frames?
Yeah.
Frames is like a website within a website within a website. It was like you have a top frame which stayed locked, and oh, that was very interesting. Don't use Java scripts or Java script links, what we were just talking about before, little pop-ups and things. If you do, include a text link at the bottom of each page. So that's going to make it easy for the spider to go from page A to page B without all the trickery that you're doing getting the user to go from page A to page B. Another important thing, avoid overusing keywords. Blue widget, blue widget, blue widget, blue widget. Yeah, that's just going to... It's not user-friendly, and it's going to be shunned.
Hello, BMW. Yep.
Yes. And the other important thing is what not to do on a web page is never cloak your domain name. This involves filling a page with very high-quality search engine content, then redirecting it to another more user-friendly site. It's a bit like, you know, trickery. So don't do that sort of things.
Using smoke and mirrors.
That's a good way of putting it, isn't it? When you and I, Dr. Ron, went to our search engine marketing and search engine optimization thing, we cornered Sam Shetty and Justin Freeman.
We bailed him up.
We got him in the corner. Yeah. We shoved a microphone in the face and asked them a few questions. And not of the 60 minutes type either. Here's some tips from the pros.
Net Registry has been doing search engine optimization for the last 4 years. And we've basically optimized more than 1,000 sites as of now. However, we've been always focused on the small to medium-sized businesses. And we have helped people improve their online presence.
Let's start off by talking about how important meter tags are. Can you tell us a bit about what a meter tag is and how we should use them on sites?
Okay, great. Now, a couple of years back when web designers used to design websites, what they used to do is they used to put in two tags on their website. One was a meta tag description. The other one was a meta tag keyword. Now, with the meta tag description, it was basically supposed to be a one-line summary of your website, just to give the search engines an indication what the website is all about. And the meta tags where basically keywords that you'll put on a website tell the search engine that these keywords are important to the website. However, as time went on, you know, people started misusing that, and they came across sites where they had heaps of keywords, like, you know, 50, 100 keywords on the meta keywords, and the meta description was like a long essay. So then the search engines realized that, you know, that's not a good way of looking at things, and they start giving less importance to that. Today, there are some search engines still, they give importance to it, okay, but not as much as they used to do it a couple of years back. However, having said that, you know, it makes a lot of difference. For example, if you have a website and some of the keywords which are important to you are misspelled very regularly, it's a good thing to put that on your meta tag keywords, because you know you don't want to spoil it on your text by having misspelled words on your website. It's a good thing to put on the meta tags.
Do some search engines look at meta tags differently to others?
Yes. I mean, to some extent, you know, Yahoo and MSN, they still look into that. Google may not to that extent, but they do. I mean, it's no harm in having it, but if you're having it, make sure that you're not overdoing it.
So overdoing it would be 100, 10, 20?
Ideally speaking, we recommend that you should have, you know, you got to understand that each page of your website could have different meta tags. Each page on your website would have a different product that you're trying to specify on. To try to make sure that the most important keywords for your website are there on the first page, okay? Try not to exceed more than 10 keywords on each page. and make sure that you're not repeating the same on each and every page.
Blogs are becoming very popular these days, especially on US servers in particular, I guess. How important is a blog in achieving links to your website?
Okay, now in terms of getting to results with search engines, it's just not one factor. There are too many factors onto it. Yes, blogs are getting important. There's a provided you have a good blog, the blog is on topic and you're making people, write good contents on it. Because the more often you get contents from, updates from various websites, Google starts giving it important because you might be, the blog might be of a topic which is of a lot of interest to people. And if you have a blog on that, then definitely it's going to help your popularity.
Now, another popular thing these days is XML files, or the files that sort of sit in the background of a website, which tells browsers about dynamic content. That's content that lives on your website, which changes regularly, such as a podcast, an RSS feed of sorts. XML files come in fairly high in the Google ranks. Do sites with XML feeds feature high for this reason?
At the moment, yes. Even if you look at recommendations from Google, when they say, you have a Google sitemap, they actually say, put in an XML sitemap. Because that's what, at the moment, there's a good, chance that if you have an XML thing coming on your website, it's going to push you up much more up the ladder.
You touch on XML sitemaps. It's something that I'm doing for each of my clients these days using the free XML generators online. Are they as good as each other or is one better than other?
What you can do is actually Google has just recently introduced something which is pretty interesting in terms of search engines. A lot of people, used to do certain Google commands on Google, like, link domain to find out how many people are linking back. But what Google has done now is you can actually go to www.google.com/webmasters. Once you log in out there, it basically will give you an entire information about your website. It'll tell you what keywords on your website has Google already picked up, how many pages of your website has been indexed by Google, and with regards to sitemap, it'll help you basically with putting up the sitemap and so on.
And one of the old myths, is it a myth? Links on the site on the same server. So if you're running, say, take for example, a Net Registry server, and you have many customers, and they're linking to each other. Is that detrimental in Google's eyes?
It's a bit of a tough one because, a company like Net Registry, for example, we have close to around 50,000 websites hosting with us, and it's not fair that, you could say that anyone, hosting with Net Registry, if someone else links to that, it's not of value because what would really happen is, you could have large ISPs, which are hosting a lot of websites, okay? And you would have one person linking to the other, but, it wouldn't be not fair for the person, if he's losing on his ranking because he is, linking to someone who's hosting the same server. So
it's a good question. Look, Google, Google's pretty smart, and I'm confident that if they see an IP that has 40 sites behind it, and each of those 40 sites are linking to each other, they could be pretty certain that it's... could be run by the same number of webmasters. However, with the increase of shared or virtual hosting where many sites share the same IP, if it looks an IP address and there is 20,000 websites behind it, I'm sure that Google's smart enough to recognise that that's a valid way of hosting. I don't think that it's... I'm of the opinion that it's not going to penalise you for a link from a shared hosting as opposed to from a dedicated hosting box on a different IP?
The reason I ask about that is because of blogs, a lot of ISPs or hosting companies will run a blog in the same web package. And obviously if you want to link back into your website, hopefully the blog is not going to penalise you or it's not going to be looked at detrimentally back into your site.
Yeah, I think it would look at the worst case scenario if links from a similar or same IP or IP range, I think at the worst case scenario they could have nil effect. They're certainly not going to have a harmful effect or penalise you.
Just because you've jumped in, Justin, can you just tell me your role at Net Registry?
Good question. Look, I'm a channel manager. I essentially look after the resellers, so the web design partners of Net Registry. So we look after web designers, network experts, but essentially our core business is web designers, people building websites and using Net Registry domain names and website hosting.
Search engine optimization has quite often been tainted with an interesting brush. Some people believe in it, some people don't. How do search engine optimization companies differ?
Essentially, search engine optimization as a service, it's increasingly it's increasingly becoming an important offering for most hosting companies. I think that the big difference between companies is the results that they've achieved. And I think that any search engine optimization company who themselves doesn't appear for search engine optimization would have a tough job convincing you to pay for their service.
So it's a good rule of thumb test, really. Go and see if they've found on the, on the search
exactly.
engine.
Exactly.
Is it possible to over-optimize a site in this day and age?
It's a tough question. I think that Google as an organization is an anti-search engine optimization, but they certainly don't want to make our job any easier. So I'm sure that Google is aware that companies sell search engine optimization, and perhaps they have a strategy to limit the success of organizations who are getting close to capitalizing on their algorithm. So look, the short answer is I don't know, but I'm certainly sure that Google's aware that search engine optimization is a multi-million dollar industry, and they need to protect their algorithm, and their algorithm is delivering relevant results based on the keyword.
Why do you think Google does have the market share that it does? Just out of curiosity, is it because they're on the block first? It's an easy word. People just remember Google, and you know, even these days, it's become its own verb almost. Why do you think Google has the market share that it does?
Look, they've got a patent. I understand that they enjoy a patent on the PageRank technology. So the linking strategies from Yahoo, 9MSN, aren't as great. Will Google always be there? I'm not sure. Look, Wiki's launching its own search engine in 2 months' time, and if that search engine gives more relevant results, you know, Google has to protect its own existence. Google's main source of income is selling pay-per-click, and if it's not delivering relevant results, it's not going to exist. So
we were discussing Wiki on the show recently, and one of the models behind Wiki was the fact that Wiki earns no money currently, and the way it can generate money is by putting its own search engine and its own pay-per-click issues there. So hence, maybe that's probably the reason why they're launching their thing, to actually generate some money.
Yeah, I understand it's run almost solely by volunteers at the moment, so it'll be interesting to see how that pans out.
All right, back to the web stuff. Anchor text, you use that terminology quite a bit. Can you tell people what anchor text is? Well, yeah, is that a question for Sam?
Yeah, sure. Basically, when you link, you know, one website to the other, okay, there are normally when you link, you know, you'd either put in a button which says click here, and it takes you to your website. Rather than putting something like click here, you could actually, you know, put a text which says, you know, web hosting Melbourne, for example. Okay, and so when someone clicks on that, it actually takes you to a website which is about web hosting provider in Melbourne. So what you're doing is, by putting in an anchor text, you're telling the search engine spider that the page that they're going to land onto is all about web hosting company in Melbourne.
You're saying remove the words click here and put in the words web hosting Melbourne and make that as your underscore.
As a hyperlink, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, okay. And another question is keywords. The word keyword assumes one word, but that's not the case. Keyword can be a string of words. How does that work?
Okay, the thing is that, you know, people use keyword and use keyword phrases, okay? So basically keyword is nothing but actually if you look at it, it's a collection of two or three words. Okay, you could, depending upon what stage of your search in, you could either put in a single word to do a search, or you could use two words, you know, together to do a search. So when we use terms in search engine optimization, when we speak to customers, we ask them what keywords are important to them. But what we actually mean is that what would someone type in Google, Yahoo, or MSN if they are to find their services? So a keyword could be a single word, it could be two words, three words, or more than that. I mean, if you look at trends, you know, someone if is typing in three words in a search, they're being a bit more specific what they're looking out for. That means they are in a stage where they might be just two or three steps away from actually making a decision. So if you're optimizing your website, it makes more sense to go for a three-word keyword rather than a single word, because when you're typing in a single word, you're just doing research. You've not made up your mind. You've not decided what you want to do. But when you search for a larger collection of words, you know, you made it very specific what you're interested in, and your decision is basically based on those 10 results which come up then.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Thanks to Net Registry for allowing us to have a chat to them like that and grilling them in the corner.
There's some good information in there. It was a good one.
It's worthwhile having a listen back if you're listening on the podcast. When you sit down and have a look at your website, have a bit of a re-listen to that and apply some of those technologies, and I reckon you'll have a website which is going to be very search engine friendly.
Thanks to Sam and Justin at Net Registry. That was a terrific afternoon. 4 weeks
to 6 months for a new site to appear on Google, they told us.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. You can speed that up. If you need to know, come talk to us.
That's all we have time for in this Tech Talk Radio summer series. We hope you've enjoyed this highlights package. Over the New Year break, we'll be maintaining the Tech Talk Radio forum, of course. So go to forum.techtalkradio.com.au for the latest news, the latest discussion, and technology updates. The official Tech Talk Radio website, of course, is techtalkradio.com.au. Don't forget, we'll be back same time, same place next week with another summer series installment. Enjoy your return to work. Enjoy your technology responsibly. I'm Dr. Ron. Bye for now.
Tech Talk Radio is brought to you each and every week by a band of dedicated professionals from within the broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer and host Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Sir Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins. Our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Production facilities are courtesy of Evolving Communications, podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night from 8 p.m. The producers wish to thank all the stations that are taking the show, including 3WBC, 3XX, Cairns FM and 4KZ. For syndication, sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit the website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.